Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, in our culture, I don't know how it is other places around the world, but here, bats are stereotyped as scary little creatures of the night, right? Like Halloween figures, along with ghosts and witches flitting along, you know, as companions of vampires and things like that. And, you know, there are all kind of bad connotations with bats. Batty means crazy, right? As in bats in the belfry. And I imagine this imagery was started by early horror movies, but it has stuck with us. But bats are actually among the most beneficial of all small mammals. And without bats, we'd be overwhelmed with insects biting us and devouring crops, because that's what they do all night long, is fly around and very efficiently eat insects. So that problem of insects biting us a lot and insects eating our crops up could actually happen. And that's why I'm doing a show this week on a dire threat facing bats in the U.S. I have two guests with me. Professor Deanne Reeder is joining us from Bucknell University. She's an expert on bats and one of the leading researchers on something called white nose syndrome, which is a disease that's been causing massive die-offs of bats in North America since around 2006, and now threatens the extinction of some species of bats. My second guest is Corey Holliday, who is a cave and karst program manager. Maybe we'll have a chance to ask what a karst is later. And he's with the Tennessee chapter of the Nature Conservancy. Corey's doing some innovative things to try to save bats from extinction. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
So I first heard of white nose syndrome from a friend of mine who's the mayor of our small town that I live in Tennessee. He's a wildlife rehabilitator, and he described the rapid die-off of bats that he's noticed, and he was aware of the white nose syndrome. So I decided to kind of look into this situation more in depth. So that's where you two come in. Deanne, could you first give us an overview of bat species diversity and populations in the whole U.S.?
Sure. In North America, we think we have about 45 species of bats distributed throughout the whole country. Most of these bats are insect eaters, which means they're incredibly beneficial to the environment. They perform what we would call ecosystem services. A number of these bats are also pollinators, so they're important in ecosystems in managing pollination and fruit production and things like that. So we have really quite a nice diversity of species. Two of our most common species of bats in North America are the little brown bat and the big brown bat, both of which are actually influenced by or affected by white nose syndrome.
They're really called the little brown bat and the big brown bat. They sound like cartoon figures.
Yeah.
So in what parts of the country are bats most prevalent, or are they pretty much equally distributed everywhere?
Bats are definitely distributed around the U.S. pretty ubiquitously, but in the Northeast in particular, and then moving through Tennessee, Kentucky, that region where we have lots and lots of caves and now mines as well that bats like to hibernate in, the populations are actually really quite high in the Northeast in particular, at least until white nose syndrome affected us.
So does anybody have any idea roughly how many bats there are in the U.S.?
Trying to estimate the number of bats in the U.S. is a really, really difficult thing to do because we don't know where they all are found, and we can do extrapolations. I would say the number's in the tens of millions, but it's really hard to get a good figure for that.
So, Corey, tell us about their lifestyle. What's a day and a night in the life of a bat like?
Well, our North American bats during the daylight hours are relatively sedentary. They are hanging out in trees and sometimes in caves and leaf litter on the forest, just resting, sleeping, sometimes nursing their young. But at nighttime, they really become active. They're the top nighttime predator in our skies, and they are actively foraging all night long as the sun is down. Many of our species can eat their own weight in a single night in insects. It's an incredible feat and a metabolism unlike any other animal on the planet.
So apart from eating insects, which is a big benefit to us all and to the whole environment, I guess, how else are they beneficial? Are there other things they do that are good for nature?
Well, outside of North America, there are a lot of fruit-eating bats and pollinating bats that are really important for plant crops and regeneration of plants in places like rainforests. But here in North America, it's really that insect control. We have a lot of agricultural pests and forest pests, things like moths and beetles, and those are the main diet of our night-flying bats. They are voracious predators, and these insects are in incredible numbers on our landscape. And without bats, it's hard to imagine what our world would be like.
So, Deanne, what is white nose syndrome that I mentioned at the beginning, and how does it affect bats?
Well, white nose syndrome is an emerging infectious disease that we first saw really in the winter 2007-2008, although we were able to backtrack it to as early as 2006. when you see an animal in a cave or mine with white nose syndrome, what you see is white fuzzy stuff on their noses and also on their wings and along their forearms and so on, which is how I got the name white nose syndrome. We later were able to discover and do the experiments to demonstrate that what causes white nose syndrome is a fungus that's now called Pseudogymnoascus destructans, or we call it PD. And this fungus is really unusual in that it's a cold-loving fungus. It prefers to grow at the cold temperatures at which bats are hibernating, so it's really sort of a perfect pathogen for them. So it grows in their skin. It actually invades into the skin through hair follicles and sebaceous glands and really destroys the wing tissue. Even though it's named white nose syndrome, we actually think that the real damage to the bat and what ultimately causes their demise is the damage that's happening to the wing. A really big question that we're just starting to get answers to is how is it that having a fungal infection in your wing membrane actually makes you die? And different folks, different labs all around the country have been really looking at this question. It turns out that there are several things that we now know, one of which is that having this fungal infection in your wings actually disrupts your hibernation patterns. So bats have to gain a lot of weight just before winter in order to survive this long period where there is nothing to eat. They drop their body temperatures down to within a couple of degrees of freezing in some cases, and they'll stay there for 12 to 15 days, and then every now and then they warm up. That kind of sort of reboots all of their physiological systems because you can't stay cold for forever. And what happens with white nose syndrome, one of the first things we noticed is that the bats were actually coming out of hibernation, doing what we call arousals, way, way too frequently. And while these arousals are necessary for the bat, they use up a lot of energy. So essentially, these bats, by coming out of hibernation over and over and over again, effectively starve to death. We also now know that what we think is happening is that the fungal infection in the wing causes them to be dehydrated because it's pulling moisture out of the wing. It causes their electrolytes, things like sodium and potassium and calcium and those sorts of things, to be out of whack. And that, we think, is then triggering these warm-ups. And so we're beginning to piece together how it is that a fungal infection is killing bats. The really big question, of course, is, you know, where did it come from? Where did the individual bat get it? And those pieces of information we're still also filling in. We think that the fungus came from Europe, although it potentially could be found in other places as well. It appears that the bats in Europe are relatively resistant to it. Our European bat colleagues have, you know, when we found white nose syndrome, they said, we see that, but we don't see the mortality. And we've now tested it, and we know that it's actually the same fungus, and their bats appear to be resistant. It's like bringing smallpox to the New World. We've got a whole bunch of animals that are completely naive to a pathogen that is very good at killing them. They pass it one bat to the next. When we see white fuzzy stuff on a bat, that's essentially all of these fungal spores. It's like this fungus's version of a mushroom, if you will. And the spores are out there, and they can easily be distributed through the fur. And the bats in hibernation, they cluster tightly together. And then when they come out of hibernation, they crawl all over each other, and they really effectively spread it from one bat to the next.
So do they only contract it while they're hibernating, or do they get it sometimes just flying around and brushing against each other in outside winter?
That's a really, really good question. We think that primarily they get it when they're hibernating. We think these caves and mines are essentially acting as reservoirs for the fungus. However, we also know that bats that survive white nose syndrome, when they leave those caves in the spring and they go to their maternity colonies, because the females will all go to these same places year after year to have their pups, in a given maternity colony, bats could be coming from lots of different locations. And we assume that they have fungal spores still in their fur, so they could be spreading it to another bat. They're not going to become sick from the disease until they themselves are hibernating again, because this fungus really doesn't grow at normal body temperatures. But they could be passing the spores in the summer to each other and spreading it that way. As soon as you go torpid again in the winter, then the fungus can take hold.
Do all bats hibernate in caves, or are some of them solitary and hibernate in trees or elsewhere?
Well, of the 45 species of bats that we have in North America, about 25 of them, we believe, use some sort of hibernation or at least prolonged torpor during the winter. Only a subset of those 25 then actually hibernate in caves and mines. And those are the ones that we think will really be susceptible to white nose syndrome. They're the ones that tend to cluster in the tens or even hundreds of thousands in some of these caves. And so we really, even though it may be the case that some other hibernators do come in contact, we expect the major mortality to be in the cave and mine hibernating species.
So a good percentage of bats don't even hibernate. I just thought they all did.
Right. So really, when you look at the latitudinal gradients in North America, they hibernate when there's nothing to eat. And so only in the north are there absolute, you know, no insects available in January and February. As you move south, some of these bats, and even sometimes the same species that's found in the north, is not going to hibernate in the south because there's food available to them.
So do you find then that the species that do not hibernate are not threatened with this and don't really show much evidence of the white-nose syndrome?
White-nose syndrome, or the presence of this fungus PD, hasn't been detected yet in any non-hibernating species, and we expect that those other species will be okay.
Hmm.
And even in the more southern ranges where the fungus has now been found, some of those animals may get sick, but they have to hibernate for a prolonged period in order for this fungus to grow and really affect them. So the farther south you go, even where white-nose is, we don't expect it to have as significant of influences as it does in the north.
Well, that's good. I guess good news for the southern parts of the country and maybe the southwest too. But so how fast is it spreading where it is spreading? Is it like a real epidemic that's going like wildfire? And what's the mortality rate?
It's really interesting. There are nine species from which we have found evidence of the fungus so far. Six of those species do, in fact, get white-nose syndrome, and we have documented mortality. Even within those six species, though, it's really quite variable in terms of which species are most susceptible. So, for example, the little brown bat, which was once the most common species in North America, is highly susceptible, around 91% mortality, and that's an incredibly high number.
Mm. Wow.
Some of the other species, big brown bats, for example, some estimates have put it at about 40%, but I actually think the number is even lower. I sometimes call big brown bats the super bat. For a variety of reasons, we think that they're actually much less susceptible. So there's going to be a lot of variation. A number of our North American hibernating bats are in the genus Myotis. That's what the little brown bat is in. And I expect that the other Myotis species, the cousins of the little brown bat, are all going to be susceptible to some degree. But there definitely is some variation. And what's really interesting, too, is that even within the zones, particularly the Northeast, where we've had massive mortality, I mean, doing field work in these areas is really, really quite depressing.
Mm.
And now the folks in Kentucky and Tennessee are seeing this. Even in those areas where we've had really high mortality, there are really interesting little pockets of survivors. So even within a given species, some animals are going to make it.
Hmm. So it's possible there is some genetic or other resistance to it here and there, which might save some species then.
Absolutely. I think this is natural selection working very hard. So the selective pressures here, being how virulent this fungus is, are really knocking out a lot of these animals, but we see some being resistant. And one of the things my lab and some other labs as well studies is who are these animals that are surviving and what hope do they have for us for the future. You know, a number of folks are working on trying to understand how many bats have died. The current estimates are that at least 5.7 million, and that's a year old, that estimate. And that includes Canada as well. That number is really quite high. And it will continue to grow, that number. I mean, white-nose syndrome has moved relatively quickly. You know, if you look at the newest maps that are available with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, there's a website, whitenosesyndrome.org, where you can find this information. It's moving west really quite rapidly. What we're trying to understand is, where is it going to go? Where can we predict where it's going to go next? Who are the species that we think are going to get it next, and what can we do to protect them? In terms of cures, there really have not been any successful things. My lab and some others have tried some drug treatments, and it appears that nothing really works. Fungal infections are really hard to treat. If you've ever had ringworm or athlete's foot, you know, you have to put medicine on it every day because they're really quite challenging, and we have those same sorts of challenges. And a lot of the antifungal drugs have really nasty side effects, and so we just have not been successful. There's a couple of different lab groups that are beginning to work on some vaccines that may hold some hope for the future.
So with all those bats dying across the landscape, Deanne, and I guess I haven't seen any lying around, you know, littering the backyard or whatever, but with millions of them dying, the question arises, is it transmissible to humans or any other mammals who might eat those dead bats? And what's the situation there?
Well, PD, this fungus that is causing white-nose syndrome, as I said before, only really grows in the cold. And so it, in theory, is really only going to be a pathogen for those animals that hibernate. And so as humans, and you know, we keep our body temperature relatively constant and relatively warm, we don't expect that it will be pathogenic for us at all, which is great news for those of us who are out there trying to work on white-nose syndrome and for people who may encounter bats.
What about bears and some animals that do hibernate? Are they at risk of it at all?
It's possible that other mammals that hibernate might encounter this fungus. We know that other mammals go into these caves, for example, but we don't have any evidence at all that it is affecting them. And I think the reason for that is because of the interesting animal that a bat is. So with the amount of surface area that the wing of a bat provides and the role that the wing plays in regulating bat physiology, I think the fungus is able to affect them in a way that it wouldn't affect some other species. So for something like a bear or a squirrel, that might go into one of these caves or mines and hibernate, I don't think that the fungus would have the same effect on them, because it would be sort of more like a ringworm infection. It wouldn't be able to really disrupt all of their physiology.
Well, that's encouraging to hear. You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. I have two guests with me today. We're talking about bats, in particular, a disease that's decimating many species of bats. My guests are Professor Deanne Reeder, who's a bat researcher at Bucknell University, and Corey Holliday, who is a project manager for the Tennessee Nature Conservancy. Corey, you're in charge of a project to try to protect at least some bats from this disease. Tell us about it.
Sure. So the Nature Conservancy really got involved in white nose syndrome in 2009. Prior to that, the disease was relatively limited to the Northeast, and I think a lot of us were really hoping it would stay there. And as we now know, that didn't happen. 2009, white nose syndrome made a big jump down the Appalachian chain into the Virginias, and it became really apparent that it was going to be a major problem, a wildlife disaster, the likes of which we've not seen. And we decided to do what the Nature Conservancy does. We used the best available science and tried to come up with a few potential strategies to this disease. And we got what we thought were the world's experts in a room together and took what we knew. And what we do know is, and knew at that time, was that the disease is caused by this fungus, as Deanne mentioned, and that the fungus is very easily controlled, at least in a laboratory setting. The unfortunate parts to controlling this disease are that bats hibernate in these cave systems, and they're extremely complex ecosystems that are really dependent on microorganisms like fungus and bacteria, and we can't responsibly go into those environments and be experimenting with control measures or really even introducing any sort of an antifungal agent. So we came up with this concept, not on our own, but with a lot of help, of sort of an artificial habitat, designing an artificial cave that bats could hibernate in and would simulate a natural environment and hopefully allow them to live a normal natural life cycle and never really know that they were being manipulated. We've built an artificial cave, and bats are extremely specific about their hibernation needs and habitat requirements. And from an engineering standpoint, it had never been done before, and we didn't really know if we could do it, but we gathered some engineers and came up with a design and built this artificial cave, and so far it's been extremely successful and is hitting the marks we want to hit. And we've located it here in Tennessee, right next to a natural cave with hundreds of thousands of hibernating bats, in hopes that that they'll take to it, and we can hopefully save really meaningful numbers at this one site. And if it's successful, this will serve hopefully as a pilot project, and we can build a lot more of these.
What are the caves made of, and how big are they? Give us an idea of the dimensions and the kind of the interior shape of them, you know.
Sure. So ours is, it's about 16 feet wide, 80 feet long, 11-foot ceiling. It's made of concrete. It's all underground, made of concrete. The walls are minimum 12 inches thick, so it's big, heavy duty, and designed to simulate a natural cave. So we have airflow that simulates a natural cold air trap hibernation cave. We have rainwater that runs through it every time it rains. And it's designed to function mechanically just like a natural system would, and passively. So it's not, we aren't using any sort of artificial humidity or air conditioning of any type. So we're not dependent on, you know, an electrical grid or anything mechanical that could fail and potentially cause harm to these bats.
Do you dig into a natural hillside, or do you start by building the shell and then cover it with dirt, or how do you make the cave a cave?
We went with a precast design. Our goal for this project is for it to serve as a pilot, so we wanted it to be very easily replicable. So we went with an international company and went to them with our design, and we were able to build our cave out of off-the-shelf bits and parts that they had that they use every day, typically in stormwater situations and overpasses and things of that nature. So it's all precast concrete poured off-site and then trucked to our location, and everything was excavated and stuck in the ground sort of like giant Legos.
Well, with it being that efficient, it sounds like it was as cost-effective as it could be, but I bet it's still expensive. How much does one cost in the end?
It is. For the construction of this project, we spent around $300,000. Some of that was R&D and just, you know, making sure we had our design down and monitoring equipment, things of that nature. We can replicate it for about a quarter million, which is still a significant amount, but the bats are definitely worth it.
So you said it was, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of bats can fit in this trailer-sized structure?
Well, tens of thousands. We built this next to an existing gray bat hibernacula, and our gray bats, they cluster in the wintertime at anywhere from about 175 to 225 bats per square foot. And we have plenty of square footage. Probably only some of it will really be optimal habitat, but certainly we have space for tens of thousands.
So, you know, a question occurs to me, won't it, especially if it's right next to a natural cave that's affected by this disease, won't your cave only protect those bats who come to hibernate in this particular artificial cave?
That's absolutely right, yeah. Again, because these caves are so sensitive, we're very cautious about experimenting in the caves in any way. So our goal was to save a subset of these bats, and that's, we thought, the best we could do. But another big benefit of this artificial cave concept is that it can serve as sort of a living laboratory. So we can experiment with things like biological controls or other control measures that maybe will have potential for use in natural cave systems in the future, but just to test them out and see how they do and how they impact the environment, that's a great use for an artificial cave like ours.
So what about, are bats like salmon? I mean, do they always come back to the same cave? How do you keep them from mingling with other bats, you know, even in the nearby cave when they come out and that kind of thing? I mean, is it a problem that there'll be some cross-contamination that'll just always go on?
They certainly will. We certainly will be getting the fungus in the cave every year. So what we're able to do is control those fungal loads by cleaning this system every summer when the bats are absent. So even though the bats are going to be mixing with other bats in the fall, and they breed in the fall, and they're certainly going to be coming into hibernation with fungal spores on them, the environmental loads will be low to zero, and based on the science we have available, we think that will allow the majority of the bats that roost in our site to survive.
But you said earlier that for other environmental reasons, you can't go in and similarly clean natural caves, right?
That's right. That's right. We don't have anything at the moment that we can really responsibly use in a natural cave system. So this is really our only option right now for saving meaningful numbers of bats that we're aware of.
So it sounds like a prototype kind of an experiment in a way, and if it works, you can ramp it up and you can save maybe a larger percentage of bats that otherwise would die and kind of maybe get them past this epidemic stage where the species can produce its own immunity and maybe continue to survive then, huh? Is that the idea?
Yeah, that's pretty well the goal. If the project is successful, and even worst case scenario, if we're not able to apply anything ever in a natural cave system, if we're able to replicate this at a pretty decent scale and save 10, 15, 20% of a particular species of bats, that is a lot better than white nose syndrome is leaving us with on its own.
Yeah. You know, there must be some other measures you can use. I mean, if this is a contamination problem, I've read, for example, that cavers going into caves, you know, just cave exploring can be part of the problem, can be spreading the fungus, right? So what other measures do you recommend or enforce or use to help to reduce the spread of the disease?
Yeah, that's really helpful for definitely, you know, reducing the chance or likelihood of a new epicenter. Places like Western United States or the mountainous regions of South America, we're very cautious about caving equipment. And even within the white nose syndrome area, all of us researchers, we decontaminate all of our equipment between every site, our clothing, everything we're wearing when we go in these sites, because we live in a global world. White nose syndrome is a real wake-up call, I think, to a lot of us that we're spreading germs, bacteria, fungus around, and it's invisible. We don't know it. So I think that's really valuable, not just for white nose syndrome, but for potentially whatever the next white nose syndrome could be.
Good point. Deanne, how much field work do you do? Do you spend most of your time out studying bats in the wild? And you must do some research there at Bucknell, so tell us about that and how that's set up.
Sure. Before white nose syndrome hit and in the first few years of white nose syndrome being in Pennsylvania, I was out in the field all the time, practically every evening. In the summer, I would be out with a group of students sampling local populations, studying immune systems, studying behavior, trying to really understand the amazing creatures that bats are. And then in the winter, we would you know, sort of very carefully do a little bit of work in caves, potentially sometimes going in with the Pennsylvania Game Commission and doing some survey work, or tracking hibernation patterns within caves, trying to figure out how many bats were in which places. And that really continued in the first couple of years of white-nose syndrome. We were very, very much in the field all the time. Now in Pennsylvania, there are very, very few bats left. I think we had two or three field nights this year in the state of Pennsylvania. And I actually had a postdoctoral fellow, Joe Johnson, from my lab, and a graduate student, Missy Meyerhofer, actually out in Kentucky this summer, collecting samples from white-nose survivors to try to understand if we think they're immunologically resistant. So we've had to go far and wide to continue to do any sort of field work. I'm primarily a field biologist. That's really what I love to do. In the early years of trying to understand white-nose syndrome, it became very clear that we needed to study this disease under more controlled conditions than we see in the wild. And so I had already developed here at Bucknell a artificial cave system, if you will, something much smaller scale than what Corey at TNC has. We have environmental chambers that are glorified refrigerators that maintain constant temperature and humidity settings, so we can mimic the conditions inside of a cave. We can bring bats in under very controlled conditions, and in some studies have actually infected them with a fungus as well to track the disease and to understand how it is that they're dying, and for those bats that do well, to understand what's different about those. So we do a lot of captive work now. We have 10 of these hibernation chambers, and each can hold maybe up to 60 bats. So for a variety of studies, including in infection trials and drug treatment trials and things like that, we do bring animals in, even sometimes from out west, animals that haven't yet been infected with the fungus. We also maintain three flight cages, one of which is a quarantine cage and has bats that are free of the fungus. And we maintain that very, very carefully and test it routinely. So we have really quite a setup for understanding the details of what this disease is doing to bats. And in understanding those details, have come up with some, you know, some nice aha moments, ways in which we think we might be able to mitigate this.
Dan, we just have a minute or so left. If you can answer this question briefly, I don't know.
Okay.
What do you see as the outlook for the future of bats in the U.S.?
I see the outlook for the future of bats in the U.S. as being really quite challenging. We're going to have a number of years where we continue to see declines. I'm hoping that with some strategies, including the really out-of-the-box thinking that folks like TNC are doing, that we'll be able to do some mitigation. But I think we're going to continue to lose bats. I think several species may, in fact, go extinct entirely. I have hope in that we are finding populations of survivors, and I hope that those survivors are going to do well enough to sort of be the seed population for regrowth. The problem is bats only have one pup a year, and so it will take a very long time to bring our populations back. We may see some ecosystem shifts in terms of numbers of insects. Things are going to fall out of balance a bit. But in the end, I think we'll always continue to have some bats in North America.
Well, it sounds like a kind of a somber situation, but hopefully it'll turn out better than we're predicting here. If you want to learn more about this situation, you can go to nature.org/artificial bat cave, all one word, artificial bat cave, and you'll find what Corey's doing there with the artificial caves that he described. I want to thank both of you for being on with us on American Variety, Professor Deanne Reeder at Bucknell and Corey Holliday at the Tennessee Nature Conservancy, and thank you for going to bat for bats, right, if I can say that. I want to thank all of you for listening out there, and I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.